Okay, thank you. So it's quite late in the day, it's 4:30, so it's one of the rare occasions when the speaker actually, you know, I know that you guys want to go home. I want to go home too. I have a 2.5-year-old at home, and last week he was waking up, I don't know why, but he was waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning. And with the time change, you can guess what time he woke up this morning. 4 a.m. Okay. So I'll try and keep it simple, but I'll talk about graph clustering and another topic called co-clustering. And this is joint work with several people at University of Texas at Austin and Dharmendra Moda, who's a very good colleague at IBM Almaden. So I have two topics, graph clustering, clustering graphs, and then I'll talk about co-clustering, multi-way data, or I'll just talk about two-way data right now, but that approach can be generalized to multi-way data. So I have a very simple message. Several of you know about spectral clustering. What I will show to you is that you can do spectral clustering without eigenvectors. That's quite not correct, okay? Because spectral clustering by itself, the term spectral means eigenvectors. So what I will show to you is that some of the objectives that are used in spectral clustering are actually exactly mathematically equivalent to an algorithm that several of you are familiar with, which is called k-means clustering, but a very, very souped up version of k-means clustering. And then I will exploit that equivalence to get a very fast multi-level algorithm that optimizes spectral clustering objectives. Okay. So it is going to be spectral clustering. Give you the goodness of spectral clustering algorithms, but without having to compute eigenvectors. Okay. So, well, what is clustering? We want to partition objects into groups such that objects within the same cluster or partition are similar to each other, and objects across different partitions are less similar to each other or dissimilar to each other. Clustering is a widespread use in various applications, not necessarily because it's an end. Okay? It's not just that, you know, people want to, you get a data set, you cluster it, you look at the groups, and then you go home and you're happy. But typically, they want to do some analysis of their data set, and then they typically might use it for some other end application, some even predictive application. So, for example, in the context of this workshop, you have a network, and then you might want to identify social groups within the network. So many, many applications. So this is the first topic. I'm going to talk about graph clustering. So the setting here is you have a network, you have vertices, you have edges between vertices, and these may be weighted edges. So the weight might convey the strength of the affinity between two vertices. And what you might want to do is you might want to partition this graph up into coherent partitions or clusters. So that's, I guess, a graph of the internet at one point of time. Okay. So if you are now given a network and you want to cluster this into different partitions, how do you measure the quality? So one obvious way to do it is to look at cuts in the graph. I have a group of people out here, I have a group of people out here, and if the weight of the edge denotes the strength of affinity between two vertices, then I might try and look for a cut in this graph which is of minimum size. That means the crossing edges between these two partitions have minimum weight. The sum of edges has minimum weight. So that's a classical problem in computer science. It's a min cut problem. It actually has there's a problem with it, because typically when you give a graph to a min cut algorithm, it'll chop up little pieces of the graph at a time. So it's good, it's polynomial time solvable, but it's not really appropriate for applications in data mining. So what people have come up is, on the other hand, you had applications where these graphs came about in circuit analysis, circuit design. So what the problem there was, you have a circuit board, each element of a graph corresponds to a circuit element, and then you have wires between these different circuit elements. And what you needed to do there was to partition the graph into exactly two parts, such that you can lay out an equal number of things on the different parts of the circuit, and you minimize the edge cut between these two partitions that are of equal size. Right? Clearly, we are not going to put that restriction over here, because the cluster that we might have, some might be small, some might be large. So some objectives that are popular are this normalized cut objective. So if I have, I can do, I guess, C-way cuts, but you can think right now about C being equals to. So I want have a partition, I have a graph, I want to partition it into two parts, and I want to partition it such that the weighted cut between my partitions is minimized. And so what's the weighted cut? This links, so in the case where C equals 2, this links VI, V minus VI, will just be the size of the cut. Okay? It's the sum of the edges or edge weights that cross between two partitions. And then I'm going to normalize it by the links that VI has to the entire graph. So this is actually, this is a nice quantity, and it was popularized in the image segmentation by Shi and Malik. And she actually was, Jiambo, she was a colleague of mine when I was a graduate student in Berkeley. And so he was using normalized cuts for image segmentation. Okay, and then this can be generalized to partitioning into C clusters or many clusters.
Excuse me, you don't specify the size of the clusters.
Yes.
So to get trivially that you get a partition which has a single node, the one with lowest degree on one side and the rest of the network on the other side?
No, it won't, because this will tend to try and, if you look at this objective, it will tend to make the clusters of equal size.
Okay.
Yeah. But it doesn't have that as an explicit requirement. So it will not be like that.
So this is just taking binary cuts?
No, this is actually C-way cuts. You can generalize the objective function to C-way.
Right.
Yeah. Or K-way. Okay. And that's what I'll actually talk about. So I like this quantity because, you know, this is on the numerator there are edge weights, and on the denominator there are edge weights. So this is actually a dimensionless quantity. Okay. This is bounded by K. And then there is ratio cut. So we will talk about these graph clustering objectives. And typically what you see is, well, if you want to minimize the normalized cut, you just have this, I'm sure most people have this in their brain, that you think about normalized cut, you think about eigenvectors. It's just an association. Okay? And what I'm going to tell you is that's not necessarily the association you should make. Okay. So spectral clustering, what does it do? What you can do is you can take this objective function. Okay, I can write it as an optimization problem. It turns out to be a quadratic optimization problem. So quadratic objective with discrete constraints on something called partition vectors. So it's an NP-hard problem. What people do is they think about taking a real relaxation of this cluster of this objective. So that means you take your quadratic objective function, and instead of having discrete constraints on your variables, you relax them to be real. And what then you can show is that that problem is trivially solvable, or trivially, the globally optimal solution is given by a particular eigenspace, and in particular by eigenvectors. So in particular, for example, in the normalized cut, you would form this matrix D minus half, A, D minus half. A is just the adjacency matrix of your graph, and D is the matrix of degrees. It's a diagonal matrix which has degrees on the diagonal. Okay. So you take this, or you can think about the identity minus D minus half, A D minus half, and this is called the graph Laplacian or the normalized Laplacian. And what you do is you compute the smallest eigenvectors of this normalized Laplacian. So that gives you the optimal solution to the relaxed problem. Okay? But then, of course, there's the question about how to go from the eigenvectors to the partitions, because that step needs to be done. So then there are various ways that you post-process the eigenvectors to actually get to the partitions. And what people have done is that if you want k-way partitions, k, let's suppose, is 100, so you want 100 clusters, people will, there's a paper called The More Eigenvectors, the Better. So over here, people will try and compute 100 eigenvectors or even more, and this matrix can actually be very large and sparse, and it can be expensive. And it can actually be even memory intensive, because you know, just think about 1 million vertices and 100 partitions. So you have to now compute 1 million eigenvectors, and each one of them, 100 eigenvectors, each one of them being a size million. I heard some rumbling out.
Yeah, the rumbling was about 1 million eigenvectors.
I meant it the other way. Million?
Yep.
Sorry, that was a typo.
Yes.
So a million.
So
vertex,
was my rumbling.
Million vertex graph, that means the size of the matrix is 1 million and 100 eigenvectors. But even that can be
expensive.
But that's spectral clustering, and that's what you associate with normalized cuts. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about something very different. That again, people who've done clustering, that's the first thing that you might think about. You have a point set, you want to partition it into k clusters. K is given above hand, k is given beforehand, and you want to try and minimize the square Euclidean distance from each point to the center, so this shows the optimal solution over here to this problem. So that's the k-means problem. Okay, and this is the k-means algorithm. It's an iterative algorithm that can take an initial partition and refine it. So it can take an initial partition. It does two steps iteratively. It computes the distance between points to all the k centers or the means, chooses the looks at the smallest distance, forms a new partition, and then estimates the parameters, which are the means. Okay. So this, it does an expectation maximization step. So you get distances out here, and then you update the cluster centroids, and you keep on repeating this. Very popular algorithm. A lot of people use it, a lot of people whip it. Right? They'll come up with a clustering algorithm and say, well, look, my method performs better than k-means. Okay? That's a favorite thing to do, but it's very popular. Okay? And there are reasons for it. It actually, it has some drawbacks. It really depends a lot on the initial clustering. It can get stuck in very poor local minima, but then you can have heuristics to try and escape from that. Okay, so that's k-means. Okay. What I can do is I can soup up k-means a little bit, and I can go from simple k-means to something called weighted kernel k-means. So there are two things I'm doing. I'm putting weights on the points. So I put weights on the objective function out here. So wi is the weight associated with the ith data point. And then I'll make a potentially a nonlinear transformation of each point to possibly higher dimensional feature space. So that's called the kernel part. So this is weight, this is kernel, and now I can have this objective function. And now I can try and say, okay, can I run k-means on this objective function? Well, the definition of the centroid changes a little bit, it just becomes a weighted average. And then what you can show is that, well, you need to compute distances between the means and each of the points. And I can expand it out. This is a square Euclidean distance. I can expand this out, and I can write this objective. Actually, I haven't put phi out here. Okay? So this is just to show you that I can compute the distance between a point and the mean, because the mean is what? It's the average of the points in a particular cluster. So I can write it solely in terms of inner products between the points. And then if you know kernel methods in machine learning, well, the kernel trick is that if you can write your algorithm in terms of inner products, then I can even if I do this nonlinear transformation to a potentially higher dimensional feature space, I actually do not have to compute this explicitly. I can just work with the kernel matrix, which is a positive semi-definite matrix, okay? N by N kernel matrix. So that's the objective function for weighted kernel k-means. So I've talked about graph clustering objectives. I've talked about a souped-up version of k-means. And what I'm going to now say is that these are actually equivalent. By putting weights on the points, by giving you a kernel in k-means, now these objectives are identical. Okay, so there are no, before I go on to this, this is the weighted kernel k-means algorithm. And one thing you'll note is, because I expanded out my center or centroid, I actually don't need any extra memory. If someone gives me a kernel matrix, there is no step which says compute the mean vectors. Because you don't need them. Because you've expanded it out, it comes up in the inner products, and this is it in terms of the kernel matrix. But the nice part is that so that's the take-home message. Let's say there's only one thing that you want to remember from this talk. It is that these weighted graph clustering objectives are mathematically identical to a weighted kernel k-means. Okay, so normalized, corresponding to normalized cut, which is a popular algorithm to do graph clustering, then I can set my node weight, or the weight to each point, wi, I can set that to the degree of the node, and I can set the kernel appropriately, and this is the degree matrix, and this is the adjacency matrix. I can set the kernel matrix to this, and then what I can show is that the optimizer for this weighted kernel k-means objective is exactly the same as the optimizer for normalized cut. So this is a statement about objectives. It's not a statement about algorithms. But then what does that mean? So that means, what does weighted kernel k-means do? The algorithm. It can take any partition, and it can improve the partition. It can refine the partition. And in fact, you can get that algorithm. So if you want to try and minimize the normalized cut in a graph, one possible algorithm is you form the kernel matrix. So again, remember, this will also be sparse if A is sparse, as typically networks are. And then you can run this weighted kernel k-means algorithm, and k-means has this property that will decrease the objective function at every step. So you'll actually get partitions that are better and better in terms of the normalized cut. So you don't need eigenvectors. But this is still not good enough, because k-means has some drawbacks. K-means has the drawback that it depends upon the initial partitioning. And so you could get stuck at a poor local optimum. So you want to try and spectral clustering, well, that's one of the reasons why it is nice, one of the reasons why it's been so successful, is because that relaxation to the problem solves the problem globally, in some sense. At least it solves the real problem, the relaxed problem globally. And then you somehow use a heuristic to get to partition from that. So there are some positives about the algorithm, the spectral clustering algorithm. So how can we get, in some sense, the quality of spectral clustering algorithms, but at very little of the cost? So here is a multi-level approach. Okay, so multi-level approaches have been used in existing software systems, Chaco and Midas, where you take an input graph and you take, for example, so think about this as a social network, for example. Okay. So then what you can do in this is, in the first step, you will coarsen the graph. So you will take two vertices, merge them together. Take two more, merge them together. And typically, you can get from n nodes over here to n divided by 2 nodes here, n divided by 4, keep on going till you get a small size out here. Now this is a small graph. You can try and do some partitioning out here. You can use a more expensive method. You can use spectral clustering over here. You get a partitioning. Then you're going to lift this partitioning up. So you're going to take this graph, replicate it over here, and this partitioning is going to induce a partition. And now you will refine this partition. And you keep on refining this partitioning until you get back your original graph. Okay. So there are two steps. One is coarsening, and then of course this base clustering, and then refinement. The success of multi-level algorithms has been that you can actually do fairly cheap steps, fairly simple things out here, and somehow you solve the problem at multiple scales, so the quality of the partitions that you get is actually very good. And that's been observed from Medius and Chaco. But what Medius and Chaco try to do is they try and solve the circuit problem, where they really want the partitions to be of nearly the same size. And in social network analysis, there's no reason why the groups should be, or the clusters should be, nearly of the same size. But hey, what can we do? I gave you a method, weighted kernel k means, of that's a method that takes an initial partition and refines it. Perfect. So what I can do is, I get this base clustering, I lift this partitioning up, and I refine it using a few steps of weighted kernel k means. I get a partitioning, I lift it, and I refine it, and I keep on doing this. And that really gives a very, very, very fast algorithm. Okay, and because each of the steps is very, very cheap, actually the kernel k-means algorithm, that iteration, can actually be written entirely in terms of the graph. So actually we can rewrite it so that there is no floating point computation. So you can, if the graph weights are integers in the beginning, I don't need to do any floating point computation in this.
So can I just ask a
philosophical
question?
Yeah, go ahead.
So of course you can embed the graph in high dimensional Euclidean space with minimal distortion.
Okay.
But I'm not embedding this stuff because it's done by successive refinements.
But I'm not doing any embedding. Did you have a particular kind of embedding in mind, like Laplacian, like eigenfunctions and so on? Or? So that's what I'm not doing. I'm not doing anything. I'm just taking the adjacency matrix.
Right. But,
yeah.
A way of thinking about this is the adjacency matrix for graph just gives you a metric. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And any endpoint metric space
mm-hmm.
can be embedded with low distortion.
Mm-hmm.
And Euclidean space of dimension C of epsilon log n.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're naturally in the space. And the thing that occurs in this, these are usually done by randomization algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
They're done by picking random partitions
mm-hmm.
and then adjusting the partitions and looking at what they would call the padding
mm-hmm.
constants.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if the whole picture, it sounds like the whole picture.
Mm-hmm. Except I'm not doing any explicit embedding. So I mean, even if I do random, you might be able to think about this coarsening as repeated embeddings.
Right.
But I'm not explicitly. I'm not even. I don't want to do even a matrix vector multiply.
This sounds to me like there's a parallel. I'm just saying that it sounds like there's a parallel description.
Okay. Okay, we can discuss that. Okay, so what I explained in the picture is what's written out here. So you have three phases, you have coarsening, you have base clustering, and you have refinement. And we can do the refinement because of this theoretical observation, because of this, that the spectral clustering objective or the weighted graph objective is mathematically identical to this weighted kernel k-means objective. Okay, so based upon this, we actually have very fast graph clustering software that's available on the web, and I'll give you a link to it at the end. And these are sort of results, and it's very fast. Okay, and we've tried hard to make the quality of the clustering good. So here is an example. This is a gene network, a network from bioinformatics. It's a gene network, 1,381 genes, around 10,000 functional linkages, okay, or edges. And if you just do a spy plot in MATLAB of the matrix originally, well, there's no pattern, but this is a regular picture that you can see when you do this clustering, that you identify these blocks over here. And you can look at the normalized cut values, okay? And you can look at spectral clustering and our software. And you know, I don't want to go into numbers too much, but you can see that when you, especially when you have large number of clusters that you're trying to find, this graph clustering algorithm actually does better than spectral algorithms. Examples, this is an IMDb dataset. This is the Internet Movie dataset. It has 1.4 million vertices, 4.3 million edges, so it's big. And if you want to try and do spectral clustering, well, if you want to try and do more eigenvectors, the better, that'll be hard. Okay? So and you may not be even to able to store these eigenvectors. And remember, in weighted kernel k-means, there's no extra memory. So I get the initial graph, I don't use more than order n the memory. So there's really no extra memory that's used. And you know, this is an example cluster. It's just to, so this is a bipartite graph actually between movies and I guess these are not necessarily even actors, but they could be actors and directors. And so this is just one sample cluster. And computation time is the big difference. So it's about 100 times faster. And that's really typically the speed ups we get, much, much faster than spectral. And these numbers are just to show that we are competitive, if not better, in terms of the normalized cut values. Okay? So we also did some benchmark results on, you know, a bunch of graphs that come up from different applications. I don't want to go into details, it's getting late. But this is, we have various variants of our algorithm. You can use different heuristics, what you use at the base level, how much local search you do, and so on. But the time taken by spectral methods is sort of normalized. The rest of the bars are normalized with respect to this, and our simple methods take much lesser time. Okay. And the quality is fairly good.
What are we seeing in this?
Okay. Yeah, I was trying to avoid getting
people.
No, that's good. I was just trying to hurry up before we go home. these are normalized cut values on the y-axis, and these are different graphs. Okay, and then spectral is this bar, so everything is normalized with respect to spectral. So spectral is at a value of 1. Okay, and these are four variants of our algorithm. That do different things at the base level, that do different kinds of local search and so on. So below this red bar means that you are getting better results in terms of normalized spectral. So below the bar is good over here, and actually above the bar is good because here we are measuring association values. So either we are sort of comparable or slightly better. A couple of times slightly worse.
More general question. So it seems like the k-mean strategy can be applied to arbitrary graph cut functions. So if I have a function like, cut value to the cut value to the cut value, right? As long as I have a way of computing, given a partitioning,
right.
I have a way of computing
right.
the overall objective.
Right.
So I can devise an algorithm irrespective of what
right.
the objective function is.
Right.
Takes every point.
Right.
Computes the cut value, the objective function value for every assignment,
right.
and assigns it to the best. And that's going to guarantee that the objective function is going to
So you can use these multi-level algorithms as long as you have a subroutine like that, which can take an initial partition and can improve it,
so
in terms of the objective.
Yes.
So some people have asked me whether I can use this for, you know, these are weighted crowd graph objectives, but in social network analysis, I'm not too familiar, but there are other things that people use, I don't know, centrality and so on. I don't know the details, but if you can somehow have an algorithm that can take an initial partition and improve that, okay, in a guaranteed manner, then you can apply these algorithms. And these are very fast algorithms.
What I'm saying is that that'll always be possible if you have a computable function, because for every point,
right,
the only thing you need to do is decide whether it stays in this partition or find a partition.
Right,
partition.
But remember that the I have to make an analogy between the kernel and the graph adjacency matrix. So it's not at the level of the algorithm itself, but we can discuss this. Okay, so now I'll come to the, so that's why the part I was going to talk about, multi-level graph clustering. So any questions, I can take them now. Or I'll move on to the second topic, which is co-clustering. Now this came up in Andrew's talk before. You may have a matrix, you may have three-way data, you may have multimodal data. And what you might want to do, you might want to cluster along different dimensions. So here I've just given you an example. The symbols are supposed to mean, so an X is supposed to be similar to this other X, okay? But you might be given a matrix which is all jumbled up. And then if I do permutations of rows and columns, I can rearrange this matrix to give you this kind of pattern. So the simultaneous clustering of rows and columns of a matrix is what I'm going to call co-clustering. It's also called bi-clustering in the literature. So what I'm going to try and do, we have a long, long paper, a 70-page paper about doing this for all Bregman divergences, where Bregman divergences are loss functions. But what I will try and do is to give you some idea as to how we formulate the problem. I really won't talk about the algorithm and the kinds of results that you might get. So given a matrix, remember this need not be square matrix, okay? And this could be a Word document matrix, different kinds of matrices. It can be actually gene expression matrix. So the numbers in this matrix may not even be positive. You could have positive and negative values in this matrix. So the question is, you have this idea of trying to get row clusters, get column clusters. What objective should you use? You know, if I had given you, shown you that picture of, let me see. I'd shown you this picture, okay? And I'd said, well, you know, if you want to cluster it, and all of you in your mind probably said, yeah, of course, yes. K means, you know, I can associate with each point a corresponding center, and that's a natural objective to use. Okay. Now, if I want to do co-clustering, how should I drive my algorithm? Should I just cluster my rows separately, cluster the columns separately, and give you the result? Or can I get some other objective? The matrices we are dealing with is quite different. So we want to have a general theory which encompasses the different matrices. So this is a Word document matrix, 176,000 non-zeros, but you can make these number of non-zeros as large as possible. This matrix is really large. Despite the way it looks on this slide, the matrix is very sparse. Okay? Typically, less than 1% of these entries are non-zero. And typically these are counts or weighted counts. So this matrix is non-negative. But you, on the other end of the spectrum, you might have gene condition matrix. And over here, each number is, you know, the biologists, they take logarithm of some intensity values divided by some base intensity value. So these numbers could be positive, negative. This matrix is dense. In universities, it's smaller because the number of genes is not going to go beyond 30 or 35,000. But each column is some experiment that a graduate student has to do.
Okay.
So the number of columns isn't too large, but I believe in industry the number of columns are in the thousands. In academia, the number of columns is in the hundreds.
Okay.
And this has negative and positive entries, and people use the Pearson correlation coefficient to measure similarities. So we now want to have a theory, okay, of co-clustering that can handle both kinds of matrices, maybe with different error functions or different views about what the goodness of a co-clustering is. So where does co-clustering arise? Well, I can start saying everywhere. Bioinformatics, text mining, people have used it in natural language processing to do named entity recognition. People have used it in video content analysis, and this is a paper published in 2003. At that time, I quite didn't understand the importance of these applications, but this is advertisers and keywords and how much advertisers bid on keywords. So you might have matrices like that, and people have applied this co-clustering to do, let's say, a market analysis of this kind of data set. So lots of applications. Okay, so what I am going to do is we are going to associate a co-clustering with an approximation of the data. So now if you think about the k-means example, the simple k-means example, well, in your mind, what you did was you approximated each data point by its center. Okay? And you said, well, I'm going to think of the goodness of a clustering. If I, for example, arrange all the data points over here as columns, and I'm going to say that the error is the approximation is you replace each point by the cluster to it or the cluster center that it belongs to, and then I'm going to take the Frobenius norm of that matrix, okay, and I'm going to try and minimize that. That's the k-means objective. What can you do in co-clustering? Well, so what we are going to say is that we are going to associate each co-clustering with a corresponding approximation of the matrix. If it's a lousy co-clustering, that means you have a lousy approximation, and vice versa. If you have a better approximation, that means I have a better co-clustering. And that's how I'm going to drive my co-clustering algorithm. So I'm not going to go into detail, but there are certain loss functions or divergence measures that are called Bregman divergences. And they have a fairly rich theory. So what we've done works for all Bregman divergences. If you don't know about Bregman divergences, just think about this as the squared loss. The entry-wise squared loss between the original data, original matrix, and the approximation. Bregman divergences allow you to generalize this to relative entropy. We heard a lot about multinomials, okay? The corresponding Bregman divergence, if the generative model is a multinomial, is exactly relative entropy. So you can do things in relative entropy also. Okay, but what am I going to, so what kind of matrix approximation am I going to associate? Okay, so here, I'll just motivate it by showing you this Alice-Bob game. So Alice knows the input data. So Alice knows the input matrix A. Bob is somewhere very far away, Santa Monica. Bob does not know the matrix A. That was a joke. It takes me an hour to get to Santa Monica. It's only 10 miles. Alice will find a co-cluster. Okay? And then she will transmit the co-clustering to Bob. That means what row belongs to what row cluster, what column belongs to what co-cluster. And then she will also transmit certain additional information, which we call summary statistics. Okay? So this could be, for example, if I think about a co-cluster as a block of that matrix, I could just transmit one number, which is the average of that block. Or I could transmit global information, which are sums of the rows and the columns. And when your original matrix you can view as a joint distribution, joint probability distribution, these would be the marginals. And what Bob needs to do in Santa Monica is, Bob does not know the matrix A, but Bob knows this information. And Bob, what he wants to try and do is, given this information, reconstruct A hat, reconstruct an approximation to A. Okay? And now what you're probably thinking, maximum entropy and so on, and that's essentially what we do. So, but we generalize it to all Bregman divergences. So it turns out that, you know, there's something called, we've defined something called minimum Bregman information, and what Bob does, given this data that Alice sends over, he will try and reconstruct an A hat, okay, which is closest in a given Bregman divergence, okay, that satisfies these summary statistics. Okay, and these summary statistics will be linear constraints in X, block sums. You can have more complicated constraints, but that will increase the complexity of your computation. And one can show that this generalizes the maximum entropy approach. And you know, it's really what you have in mind, that you know, given any extra information, Bob will try and reconstruct as uniform an approximation as possible. Okay, so that's, and then you know, we have so what I talked about in one slide out here, we have, you know, 30, 40 pages in a paper. Okay, so if you want to look at the detail, you can look over there. But we have this formulation, and then we have a corresponding algorithm to get to A hat. So we will associate, we'll start with a co-clustering, we'll get a corresponding approximation, okay, and we'll judge the goodness of the co-clustering by that approximation, and then we'll iterate, okay, so that the approximation gets better and better, and that's how we'll judge the quality of our co-clustering. Okay, so these are some results. So what's actually interesting is, well, you might have heard about the dangers of clustering high-dimensional data. You have high-dimensional data, there's this curse of dimensionality, and you have to estimate too many parameters. And so many times what people will do is do a projection of your data into a low-dimensional space, and then you'll use some clustering in the low dimension. Removes this problem of the curse, or tries to remove it, the curse of dimensionality. Well, it turns out that the co-clustering algorithm we have actually does a dimensionality reduction at every step, because you are sort of collapsing, you know, for example, if you're trying to cluster columns, you sort of take into account the clustering along the rows. So that does an implicit dimensionality reduction. Okay. So what we found is that even if you are interested in one-way clustering of your data, okay, suppose you just are given a really, let's say, tall, skinny matrix, and you wanted to cluster the columns, it might actually benefit you to do a co-cluster, cluster the rows also, even if you don't care about the clustering of the rows. Okay, and this is actually comes up because, for example, if this is a data set, what data set is this? Classic 3, it's a mixture of three classic data sets that Salton had at Cornell, and if you use 20 word clusters, then you can see that the confusion matrix is quite good. That means the algorithm is actually able to recover the three underlying topics in the data set. So this is an easy data set, but you can see that if you have a large number of words or word clusters, the algorithm actually does not do that well. So that's a little bit of evidence that says that even if you are interested in one-dimensional clustering, hey, you might want to do co-cluster. So this is also, you remember the matrix that I showed you a few slides ago? Didn't seem to have any structure. If I do co-clustering on it, then you get this pie plot and do the permutation. So here you see three document clusters. There are three clusters out here. And I think here I use 20 word clusters. And this shows actually the nature of how sort of words appear in documents. For example, this word cluster is really, these are words that really are contained only in the first document cluster, not in the second or the third. But then there are some other word clusters, like this, that are spread uniformly over the three document clusters. So I cannot associate, you know, this is the nature of English language, right? I mean, I cannot say that I have a document cluster and I'm going to associate word clusters with exactly one document cluster. So this association naturally pops out. So for example, in this case, we would, as one of the outputs of the algorithm, we would get a 20 by 3 matrix. The 20 would be the number of word clusters, the 3 would be the number of column clusters, and this matrix, I can look at that, and that'll give me a joint distribution between the word clusters and the column clusters. So here's a gene expression leukemia data set. So we heard about, so before I go on, you know, in this previous example, we had used relative entropy as the measure of distance. Multinomials are used widely in modeling document collections, and that's a natural distance measure that comes up, relative entropy. And over here, when you have in gene expression data, there is Pearson correlation coefficient, which is just basically the L2 distance between normalized vectors, normalized and scaled. So here is a picture, and you can see that this co-clustering sort of identifies, you know, coherent genes and different kinds of leukemia samples. And you can see that the picture kind of looks coherent. And this is all, of course, done in a totally unsupervised manner. And I think in this case, we had, you know, this is labeled. The columns are labeled by the three different kinds of leukemia. And I think we got like two errors. Okay? Mostly people treat this as a supervised problem, where you have a training set and you have a test set, and then you have some classification algorithm and you measure accuracy. But this was done in a totally unsupervised manner, and we've done experiments, and there's a paper that will appear in IEEE Transactions on Computational Biology, which shows that in many of these gene expression data sets, clustering itself may not do that well, but co-clustering actually does very well. Okay, so to finish, two messages. If you're thinking about graph clustering, if you're thinking about spectral clustering or normalized cuts, you have a choice now. Okay, so you don't have to take, you know, your this association that everyone has that if you're trying to minimize normalized cut, you better compute the eigenvectors. You can use this multi-level method. And this multi-level algorithm is very fast, okay? And we are trying to make it better in terms of quality because there are various heuristics at different steps. And I firmly think that co-clustering is becoming a technology where more and more people are starting to use it. As I said, not necessarily for just looking at the clustering, but also for example, regression applications, because prediction applications, because there's a lot of structure in this co-occurrence. And if you have some prediction, you can actually try and make use of what items are similar to other this item and then use it in a least square sense, for example. We have clustering software, so if you're curious, I would welcome you to download the software and try it. Okay, it's fast, and we'd welcome feedback because we are looking to improve the algorithm. The corresponding paper that goes along with the software will appear in, maybe it has a paper, okay, in the IEEE Transactions on Pattern Analysis and Machine Intelligence. And the co-clustering paper is actually, you know, pretty long, and that just appeared in JMLR. It took us, I don't know, 4 years, right?
2 years.
2 years. He's being I don't know. It took us 4 years. But to, you know, we actually published something in 2004 and it took us a long time to actually sit down and write it out properly. Okay, so I've managed to finish on time, so we can all go home. Okay, thank you.